In this conversation, I had the pleasure of chatting with John Carroll, Professor Emeritus in Sociology at La Trobe University. John's work focuses on culture and its crucial role in the human search for meaning. For those unfamiliar with John's work, you can often find him as a contributor in the Weekend Australian newspaper. Early in May this year, I read an article that John had written in the paper titled Coronavirus and the Great Age of Uncertainty. His article inspired me to read some of his other works on culture and meaning, including his books The Existential Jesus, The Wreck of Western Culture, Humanism Revisited, and finally the book I'd almost finished by the time we had our conversation, Ego and Soul, The Modern West in Search of Meaning. John's books consider the cultural underpinnings of Western civilization, and I found them so helpful to contemplate during this time of great uncertainty. Being personally sensitive to the collective anxiety that many of us are currently experiencing, I found in John's books a balm to soothe my recently amplified existential angst. In our chat, we discuss questions of meaning, but also look to the future in terms of potential impacts on current and emerging trends from his sociological perspective. We also discuss the recently proposed government policies on picking winners within university education and its likely impact on culture. It was a pleasure to chat with John. There is depth and nuance to John's perspective that I only really started to grasp when re-listening to our chat. I hope you find the conversation as interesting as I did. Enjoy. This is David Hobart from Beyond the Obvious, the podcast in search of unexpected insights for investment professionals. John, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me today. It's such a gift to have a chat with you at such an interesting time for Western culture. In a time with so much uncertainty presenting itself, some of the themes you write about in your books relating to meaning are so timely and relevant. I figured it'd be a great place to start, perhaps to ask your thoughts, given the uncertainty that we're currently facing around coronavirus, how you think that uncertainty is impacting meaning for us individually and also as a culture.
Well, we do live in a very, very unusual time, which has really not been with us since the Second World War or even the Great Depression in terms of social disruption and all or many of the normal things people take for granted in their lives, in families, at work, in their wider societies being under threat and in many parts of the world being really radically uprooted. In a time like this, it's true. I mean, it's a time of great uncertainty. People are much more thrown back on their own resources. They're sort of torn out of what you might call their normal complacencies and set ways of seeing themselves in the world. In such a time of uncertainty and unease, one of the things that happens is clearly general levels of anxiety go up. And the society is disrupted at two levels, two obvious levels. One's the general society level, which is then the business of governments, and in the particular case for pandemic medical officers, to try and stabilise and get in order and steer. And I think in the Australian case, we've been pretty fortunate with our leadership. And I mean, as a result, the country's got, 100 deaths compared to 50 or 60,000 deaths in Britain. Britain's just over double our population. The other area of challenge is to the individual, and the anxiety, uncertainty of this sort, I think, raises questions in many about, you know, who am I? What am I doing here? What's the point of my life? Where's it going? And questions of fate. I mean, where does, you know, something like this, we thought the modern industrial West with our levels of technology and medicine, hygiene, we were in sort of invincible and not vulnerable to something like this, but yet we're suddenly exposed like an avenging god. As, I mean, most people don't believe in avenging gods anymore. We've been struck as if by an avenging god. At that point, I think the questions of the central questions of life meaning come to the fore.
Yeah, sure. And so, you know, having read some of your stuff, John, you know, you frame them in a particular way, and I think it's probably instructive for the listener to get a sense of those particular root questions.
Well, I think in one should always go back to first principles in these sort of grand discussions. I mean, I once did a degree in mathematics, which turned out to be largely a waste of time. I think apart from the lesson in mathematics is always go to first principles. And in terms of the life questions, we're in the sphere of culture. We're in this sphere of how do we understand ourselves? What do we believe? What do we value? And our best guys in any culture, and we're part of Western culture, but the same would be true of China, in China or in India. In any culture, the best guides are the great stories, the archetypal mythological stories. Usually they come from a long time ago, you know, what the Australian Aborigines call the dreaming. In the case of the West, our big stories come from ancient Greece and especially Greek tragedy, and also from the Jesus narratives. Now, without to a naive view, that's a long time ago and long gone, and what's that of relevance to me? I mean, it's of relevance to you because these stories keep getting retold, and they get retold in every new forms that speak to the times. So although, you know, maybe the majority of people don't really believe in Jesus anymore, there is a sort of need for a saviour. We see sort of yearnings for saviour figures that recur in sporting heroes, recur in sort of charismatic politicians like, say, Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill. Celebrities in part tap into this, or certainly someone like Princess Diana. Diana did. Now, I think what's going on behind the scenes is a sort of need for we're back to the, you know, why am I here? What's the point of my life? We need an example of how to live. And in the case of Jesus himself, he's someone who also taught. And he taught, you know, in response to the question, what's life about? I've written a book on Mark's gospel, the first written of the gospels. I think his Jesus, who's different from the Jesus in the other gospels, is very much a teacher about the nature of the I or of being, of self, which I think speaks very much today. So what I'm really saying is when under pressure and in normal times, unlike pandemic times, that tends to come in times of tragedy. If someone's very sick, someone dies, someone close to you dies, then these questions are reawakened. But when they're reawakened, then our best guides is the great music, the great art, the films that take up, many of the best modern films take up themes like the nature of a saving individual, he or she, what form they come in. The American Western did that. Today, maybe people are more familiar with the great American series, The Sopranos, the central character, sure, a mafia boss. That program's all about fear of death, and me and Tony is beside himself with terror at you know, what's my life about? And that his panic attacks are over the fact he's going to die. And, you know, through 86 episodes, he sort of moves through life as we all do, but he fails. I mean, it doesn't. And it's a sort of tragic account. Now, that's today. Now, there's a groping in that series, just to use that example, for a saviour figure. He actually finds it right at the start in a flock of wild ducks. Those who are listening, yeah, know The Sopranos, the wild ducks land in his swimming pool. And he's completely enchanted. He's over the moon at this, you know, these things that have just arrived and landed. Then they fly away and they don't come back, and he has a panic attack. He collapses unconscious as a sort of symbolic death at the flight of the ducks leaving. Now, this is a bit like the Holy Spirit in Christian teaching that arrives from up above, from the heavens, from wherever, and brings hope and brings the sort of possibility of enchantment into Tony's life. But unfortunately for him, they leave and they don't come back. So that would be an example of a very contemporary way of, and this is a sort of a partly evil mafia boss, causes a lot of destruction. Obviously not a likable figure at that level, but you know, he's sort of everyman. The series is so popular because the audience identifies with the characters in it, starting with him. And identifies in a very ambivalent way, obviously. There's lots of Tony Soprano that no one would want to be like. Mm-hmm. So coming back to the main point, we have guides in our culture to help us in these times. The universities, their traditional role, especially in humanities, was to teach Shakespeare, Jane Austen, the history, past history, learn from ourselves, our traditions, this sort of notable characters in the past of the culture, and from the culture's great stories. The humanities departments and universities have largely stopped doing that. I think probably one reason why the government's about to make it much more expensive for students in Australia to do humanities courses.
So, John, is that the humanities, you know, the original purpose as you describe in the humanities departments, is that all about, in your view, helping the youth to frame meaning, like in their life, and to give them a sense of how to think? And is that kind of what their original purpose was, in your view?
Yes, absolutely. The mission, and it's the same as the mission of art, it's the mission of any serious cultural endeavour, including the humanities, is to think about life and its meaning, and basically to help people, help others deal with difficult times, tragic times, sort of to hold the hand, as it were, in the pandemic, through a time like this. Well, the humanities throughout the West, it's not just Australia, I mean, we followed Britain, United States, has largely abandoned this and has started to, I mean, I'll bet there isn't one university in Australia where you can read a novel of Jane Austen, unless it's in a course that's heavily politicised, like her views on colonialism, which, you know, is completely trivial to her interests. There are hardly any courses left on Shakespeare. Really, you know, central masterworks of our culture and just not being taught. That's with the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, which has now got going and it's coming into three universities. That's including University of Queensland, where you are. That's a counter movement, and that's a very, very positive thing. I think. I mean, you're in Brisbane, you're lucky. You're going to have Ramsey Centre at the University of Queensland, but it's completely counter the times. I mean, the government doubling the fees for humanities students, I don't think it's going to make much difference to enrolments because fees are covered by the loans, the HEX loan scheme. But humanities faculty...
Do you think that might, though, I mean, given, as you described, it may not impact demand because there's a sort of, you know, in economics parlance, an inelasticity of demand for specific types of courses. If you're no good at maths, you're not going to do maths. But do you think it will impact the curricula of the humanities departments? Will it make them shift again, like sort of out of that, well, the current almost ideological?
No, you don't think
it will?
No, the only way that's going to happen is with something like the Ramsey Centre, but it's only got enough money for three universities. No, the existing staff in universities and largely the existing management in universities is politicised to look at the world in this way, and it's really humanities faculties have been running down for the last 20 years. They're becoming student numbers are going down steadily, and they're going down steadily, I think, largely because they've become irrelevant. They've politicised. They're boring to most students. I mean, I've spent my career teaching in them, and it's shocking what's happened in the last 20 years. And it's understandable that more students want to do commerce or law. and get, you know, sort of substantive education rather than, I mean, the old ideal of doing humanities was to become well-educated, to better understand the world, the history of your society, how it functions, understand, you know, theories of individuals under stress through literature and philosophy. It's a very, very noble and very important social task, the traditional humanities faculty, but that's largely gone now. So, I mean, I personally won't lament the current humanities faculties withering away. I mean, they'll be replaced. I mean, this will come back because people need to go to sources of important meaning in their lives. I mean, there's an irrepressible need for what the humanities do. And, you know, the Ramsey Centre in Australia has sprung up, I mean, precisely to answer that need. I think the Catholic University, I mean, there's so much that's wrong with the Catholic Church at present in Australia and elsewhere, but the Australian Catholic University is still a bit more traditionalist and is doing a much better job in, you know, to generalise, a much better job in humanities and social sciences than most of the other universities.
Sure. So it's almost ironic because it occurs to me that the government, well, I mean, it hasn't been legislated, but in their recent comments about trying to build incentives into product offering within the universities, you know, as you say, by increasing the cost of humanities courses and decreasing the cost of almost polytechnic kind of courses.
Yes.
But in the private sector end, at least in the world that I reside in, it's almost like there's a yearning for graduates that can think independently, that can view the world with a open mind and show some resilience in the face of uncertainty and you know, and these are all the kind of qualities that emanate from, as you describe, those classical humanities style degrees. Well, at least in the traditional sense, perhaps not you know, in the mainstream of the humanities departments today, but it's almost like government engineering is sort of, whilst it may be with the tide at the minute, it's almost like the tide feels to me like it's turning. And but I mean, I don't know if that's your observation.
I think that's a hopeful I think it will turn. It's a question of how slowly or how abruptly, and something like the current pandemic does bring a reality principle, and sort of a lot of nonsense will disappear with it, sort of check. But you're absolutely right. I mean, that was the great virtue of people with traditional training in the humanities. They've been taught to think. They've been taught to write good English with a big vocabulary. I mean, the English civil service used to only take graduates who'd been trained in classics, in Greek and Roman, and so on, precisely on the basis that you were arguing, that they've actually learned to, these students we know have learned to think. They've done rigorous courses in Latin and Greek, and their minds have been opened. And at that point, that's what we want. When they come into this particular job or that particular job or their specialisation, we'll know they'll adjust to that very quickly. They don't need specific training in it. One thing I can say for students still who do humanities, they have at least proved that they can sit down in a disciplined way, write essays, produce work to set timetables, and they're sort of graded and credentialed. And there is at least still, in a most basic level, a training in discipline, in self-discipline. So, you know, an employer can have some confidence, I think, in most cases, or maybe you'll disagree even with this, some confidence that the person they're employing, you know, is capable of concentrated work over a period of time.
Sure. No, definitely wouldn't disagree with that. But again, that's a little bit case by case, but
Of course, as it always is.
So, John, coming back to, you know, where we are today, we're not, I mean, it doesn't almost, we may in Melbourne feel like we're in the midst of a pandemic again. It certainly doesn't feel like that in Queensland at the minute. But
Yeah, no, it doesn't quite look like that down. And look, you've got to just look at the basic figures. Australia's had 100 deaths compared to, you know, look at almost any other Western country. You know, we're doing very well. I mean, there was problems here with the Ruby Princess in Sydney and the health department. Victoria's got a big problem with its health department, and it's really slack running of quarantine hotels. But the truth is, I suppose we don't know with this pandemic, but I wouldn't be too fussed at present. I think Australia will get on top of it, or Victoria or Australia will stroke. Australia will get on top of this.
Yeah, sure. So more broadly, though, like if we think of, you know, economies or countries, I should say, rather than economies, countries like the USA or Britain, the impact of this virus on meaning, you know, in terms of how we define ourselves and what's important to us, and do you think any of those impacts on meaning will be lasting, or are they just sort of superficial and fleeting, you know, like on shopping or on, you know, other things? Like what's your view on that?
It's very, very hard to read. The most visible impact clearly going to be in the economy, with businesses that fail and people who are lose their jobs and struggling to survive and pay mortgages and keep their houses, and how they respond to that. I mean, there are signs that levels of mental illness have gone up during COVID, which you'd expect. I mean, the extra pressure, the uncertainty, puts pressure on everybody. And
sure,
the more vulnerable, in many cases, will respond not as well. I'm a sociologist. Sociologists have a very bad reputation for forecasting the future.
Economists, John, yeah, so like you're in pretty fine company there.
Well, actually, I think we're better than economists in that we're less confident about our predictions. Yeah. No, sure. I love, you probably know John Kenneth Galbraith's comment about economic forecasting. It was economic forecasting was invented to give astrology a good name.
Yeah. Well, let's just say there'd be a few economists listening.
Yeah. Sorry. Going back to your serious question, yeah. I think the one thing you can say is that harder times, where, you know, the central things of living and survival and being put back on your families and do bring a reality principle and make people more sensible and make less vulnerable to silly fantasies and, you know, extreme political causes. I think, you know, this is one of the good things about this, that the sort of silly ideas on the extreme left and on the extreme right will have less cogency in a time of real, threat.
Yeah. You're certainly seeing that in the way that the general populace is responding to the Morrison government in terms of, you know, the polls, et cetera. They're embracing them a lot more than they were prior.
Yes, and he sort of represents a sort of centre, maybe slightly right of centre, but basically a sort of common sense, ordinary man in the street, but very effective political leader who's not caught up in ideology of left or right. And, yeah, that is attractive at this. Yeah, I agree with you. He'll be a beneficiary unless he makes some major bungle. It will be very hard for the Labor Party to get back in office, I think.
So, John, as you know, I'm involved in finance and investing, as are many of our listeners, and I thought it might be interesting to hear your thoughts on some potential impacts on investment trends from your sort of cultural or sociological perspective, particularly in relation to COVID-19. As one example, in your book, Ego and Soul, you talk about the motor vehicle and its kind of liberating impact on the individual, or perhaps its culturally liberating impact on the individual. It had me starting to think about autonomous vehicles as an example. Like, this is just one very, very small slither or microcosm of a potential impact. But in the investment world, autonomous vehicles is something that a lot of people are looking at. And from a cultural perspective, you know, is it something that potentially could accelerate as a consequence of the pandemic, do you think?
I doubt that one. I mean, I'm very sceptical about, you know, driverless vehicles. It only takes one to go wrong and one person to get knocked over, and it's very different than having a human at the controls. The areas I'd choose, I think the when people have written about this, I've written about it in the newspapers too, the office is, I think, going to change. That one of the, there probably was a slow shift away from, you know, the 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, going into the CBDs to the office. That shift is really been radically accelerated, and that more and more people are going to be working from home. I mean, I was reading about a large international law company with, I think it was 7,000 employees, and the CEO was saying, well, from now on, I think we're going to do 90% of our work. This is post-pandemic, 90% of our work from home. And so we're going to see quite significant shifts in the CBDs in terms of the use of those tall buildings. Mm. I think that's one area. I mean, back to the first principles of capitalism, I think Joseph Schumpeter put his finger on it. The central principle of capitalism is creative destruction. Well, we're seeing a lot of destruction with the pandemic, more than in normal times. What there'll be creation afterwards, but a lot of that we can't predict. I mean, that's one of the joys and excitements of capitalism. You don't know where the new green shoots are going to be. I mean, I'm living in Melbourne. I'm seeing pretty much the death of the car industry in the early 1990s. You basically thought that Melbourne was going to turn into what happened to Detroit. It was going to turn into a rust bucket city with no future. That didn't happen at all. In fact, on the contrary, Melbourne has really flourished in the 30 years since then. Partly due to having a broad economy, not just a one-dimensional economy. I mean, this is Adelaide's problem. Its economy is way too one-dimensional. But also who would have foreseen the growth of the universities in terms of foreign students, sort of the flow of foreign students into Australian universities? I mean, I certainly would never have predicted that. Who would have predicted the flourishing of Australian tourism? I mean, partly, well, maybe mainly because of Asians at that time. And I mean, I was worried in 1990 about the Australian balance of payments. If you don't produce your own cars, you're going to import a lot more. How are we going to pay for it? But, you know, our balance of payments has been pretty healthy ever since due to things like tourism and foreign students and Australia finding new ways of competing internationally. Now, that's going to happen post-COVID, there's no question about that. But what new businesses are going? I mean, this is your business, this is your area. What new businesses are going to emerge, and in what forms? I mean, what else do you think? I actually, the driverless car, as I said, I'm sceptical about.
I suppose I asked you that in the context which I didn't sort of frame particularly well, but the role of the motor vehicle as a counterbalance in terms of the impact of meaning, when religion is removed, and you know, so what you're left with is sport, and what you're left with is consumerism, and what you're left with is, you know, you talk allegorically around the motor vehicle, but when suddenly that's taken from the individual, what impact does that have on? I mean, they'll replace that with something. I'm at a guess in terms of meaning.
Well, the motor vehicle, I think, is largely a convenience for getting you around. I think in terms of the meaning question, if the office does, say, contract radically, people are working more from home, that's going to place even more importance on the family, on the vibrancy of the family, the good relations within it or the bad. It's going to place the strain of on sure. families where there's sort of discontent within them. I think we've found that with the pandemic already.
And the strip mall too, I suppose, like the local community, and so it's out of larger shopping centres and into
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, and really the local retail shopping strip. I mean, that's another obvious that's being accelerated by the pandemic. That I don't think our local retail suburban shopping strips are ever going to be the same.
Well, I was wondering whether it might go the other way, in that, you know, you come out of the what are those big ones in Melbourne?
The Westfield, Chadstones, and the big
exactly. You come out of them. And because everyone's now working from home, they still need a sense of community, so they wander up to the shops. I mean, you get that a lot in Melbourne now anyway.
Yeah, cafes particularly.
Once people are beyond the threat of capturing, you know, getting a virus, their habits may well have shifted sufficiently. They're out of the office, you know, they're more in their local community. So the strip mall might do better than the strip shops might do better than the shopping malls. But I mean, that's a at the margin thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think the tendency is the opposite way with that. I think that in the local areas, the cafes and to a lesser degree the restaurants will do very well. But sure. People are getting out of it. It'll be a bit like Central European cultures where people live in apartments and just love to go to the local cafe just to get out and to meet people.
Yeah,
that
sure.
trend in Australia will continue and probably get even stronger. One of the positives probably if the office does go into decline, then the long commutes from in middle or outer suburbs into the city will decline. And so the pain of an hour and a half each way in the car, that'll be a distinct positive, and a greater shift towards bicycling will also be positive. Maybe this will help mid suburb satellite areas. I mean, in Melbourne, we've got things like Box Hill developing as hubs, independent from the CBD. And, you know, I know you've got those in Brisbane too, and Sydney's. All our cities have got those sort of hubs. Mm. This will maybe help them to develop. I mean, there have been some predictions that people are going to go to the country towns if you don't have to work in the CBDs. I've got my doubts about that. I think, you know, people have been, sociology has been predicting this for decades, that the sort of the lifestyle in the country town is much more attractive. But I don't know, in general, people like the hubbub. They like the buzz. They like the excitement of the city. And the country town just doesn't have that.
Yeah, it's interesting. But I also think sociologists, you know, your view of the world in your study of history is very, very long, and yet we live a finite human, you know, we're here for 800 years, so we kind of frame things as they've got to happen yesterday or tomorrow, or they'll happen over the next 2 or 3 years, when, you know, the sociologist's view of the world is very long term. So I wouldn't talk down the fact that, you know, sociologists have been talking that up for a while and it hasn't happened. It might be that there are certain things that cause smaller cities to pop up, the regions to become a little bit more prosperous, and perhaps this, you know, might contribute. I mean, I don't have a strong view either way, but it may be, you know, might be things like, I mean, I think a universal basic income is probably miles away, but something like that, where you have a more deregulated labour market, you know, could lead to all sorts of, you know,
it's possible. Look, it's possible. I mean, I remember the Whitlam government they tried to turn this into a policy, and their model town was Albury Wodonga. They thought, you know, basically half between Melbourne and Sydney. We'll turn that into the new big Australian city, and we'll force some government departments to go there. We'll encourage corporations to go there. It completely flopped. It flopped mainly because the sort of senior management, chief executives, didn't want to live in Albury. They wanted to live in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, or wherever. They actually did that lifestyle, being close to the Alps, close to skiing, you know, pleasant country town on the river. None of that worked.
Yeah.
And I suspect that's not going to change. There will be sea changes and what tree changes, whatever the jargon is these days, that will go on. But I think that's going to be a very small minority.
Yeah, sure. John, could I sort of digress a little bit and just ask you a little bit about your personal drive and curiosity? Because, I mean, I've now read a few of your books, and firstly, I mean, your read of history, your nuanced view of history is, like, I find fascinating, and I've really enjoyed the books that I've read. But also your turn of phrase, like you're a wordsmith, which is, you know, delightful. I really, really value the fact that you can weave a narrative inside a narrative and do it in such an entertaining way. So that's wonderful. Now, to the question, like, what is it that drives your curiosity personally? Like, because, you've been doing it for a long time and you just seem so, you know, interested in life and things generally.
I think it's how I was made. It's inborn. I'm just fortunate that whatever sort of innermost fibres of my being, to quote the great German sociologist Max Weber, they led to me finding work which suited. I was extremely fortunate, found writing and teaching. I've always found teaching very fulfilling. Work that, look, the older I've got, the more I think that most stuff's inborn. You know, there's the old argument of heredity versus environment, but I think you look at children, look at the people you meet, they're born who they are, largely. I mean, the environment does play some role, of course, especially extreme environments, we know that, but I was born with the drives I had. I'm a writer. I get up in the morning wanting to write, and that's writing comes easily to me, which is, again, very, very great good fortune. I'm lucky in that regard.
So are we.
Thank you. And in terms of words and language, my mother was an art teacher, and I grew up on English poetry and Western art. So, I mean, that's a case of environment to, I think, some degree. I still went to, well, schools, I think our schools are still pretty good, but I did a lot of Shakespeare when I was in senior school, and so reading Shakespeare gives you tunes you into the rhythms of the English language at its best. That's been, I think, that looking back was a big influence on me. I mean, less the Bible in my case, because that's the other great source of beautiful English language. But it's very complex. I mean, I don't think we understand what drives us. A lot of Freud's right, almost everything's unconscious. And two, you know, it's largely inborn.
So the most recent book, Ego and Soul, that I've, like I say, almost finished reading, there's this balance between, in the Western tradition, there's a balance between fortifying or validating or the ego, like, you know, in terms of identity and the soul. So you talk about that eloquently and you frame it really well, but how do you approach that personally? Like, as a sociologist is one thing, but what's your experience with finding that balance?
Well, I think our lives are largely lived for, I'm going back to Freud, the unconscious rules. Our lives are lived for us by something within that guides us, just like something within dreams our dreams. I don't think it's very smart to think consciously about how you're going to lead your life. I mean, you can do that to some degree, of course. I mean, our rational faculty is very important. But I mean, largely we follow our instincts and what sort of inner drives we have in relationship to the ego. Determines so much of what we do, and we're all very self-esteem, self-interested, egoistic. Our achievements, our performances, our desire, good and bad, to impress others, more good than bad, to produce works that are of high quality. All of that, I think, is largely linked to the ego. On the other hand, there is a part of us, a sort of more, the soul part, which yearns for some sort of higher or spiritual connection with something bigger than ourselves. Maybe the best use of consciousness is to remind ourselves more frequently than I think we ever do that our ego is pretty fickle, and to check our pride, to check our brashness, to check our self-satisfaction, and just to remember that the achievements of the ego are probably pretty mediocre and modest, and shouldn't be overvalued. I think a lot of the vices or character defects we see in ourselves and in others are maybe best checked by that sort of standing back and saying, get a grip of yourself, calm down, take a cold shower. So I think, just to come back to your question, I think the main area in which we can sort of consciously or self-consciously find a better balance is checking some of the excesses of the ego. There are other cultures, like Buddhism, which probably place much more emphasis on soul than on ego than the West has. The strength of the West, I think, has been a sort of a wrestling between the two, and so the West has been very productive. We've produced an extraordinary civilization, which we all, anyone in their right minds, should be extremely grateful for. But our, there are excesses on, obviously, the excesses of ego and greed and self-interest. But on the same time, a dynamic, buoyant society depends on competition between striving, competing, dynamic individuals, and beating each other up, building businesses that are better than other businesses, producing works of art that are better than other works of art. A lot of the best, a lot of the greatest creations in our culture come from that very competitive spirit. So we've got to be a bit careful in, moralising in this area.
Wow. No, that's great. John, I'm very conscious of your time, and I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to sit down and have a chat with you for a brief moment. Is there anything that, parting-wise, that you'd like to kind of communicate? Anything you'd like the world to hear at this moment, or the small world that listens to this podcast?
Historically, it's important to remember what a wonderful place the modern West is compared to the pre-modern world. We're so free from the sufferings that befell most of our ancestors in the pre-modern world that we really should be grateful for the way the West, in our particular society, Australia, is one of the best places in the West to live. We should be grateful. I think we should be grateful for all of that. And also remember that, the pandemic we're in 2020 is passing. I think just be grateful for what we've been given, and do your best to contribute to keeping that going.
Yeah, perfect. That's great. So, John, where can people, if they want to reach out to you or if they want to read some of your works, how would you recommend they get in touch?
I have a website, John Carroll Sociologist. .wordpress.com. That's probably the best place to go.
I'll certainly put all that down in the show notes. John, that's fantastic. Well, thanks again. I really, really appreciate your time today, John. It was a great chat, and I'm sure if people want to get in touch, they certainly will.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. It's been my pleasure, and all the best to you and your family.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
That's it for today's episode of Beyond the Obvious. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a favourable rating or review in the App Store. If you'd like to get in touch, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. Until next time, hooray.